Chapter 13. Hosha waited at the side of the street for her to arrive. It wasn't mid-morning yet, but already a small crowd of curious locals had gathered along the sidewalk. Two police cruisers had parked nearby, their constables directing the cop bots as they set up temporary barriers around the 30-story condo building. As he watched, yet another big police technical support van pulled up and slowly nosed its way down into the underground garage. His e-butler told him the precinct commander was on his way, and the city commissioner had asked for the ICE department case files. "Great," Hosha muttered. It was going to turn into one big jurisdictional free-for-all. He was sure of that. Now all the real work had been done, every other department in Dark Lake would be after a slice of the credit. An unmarked police car drew up beside him. Paula stepped out. She was wearing a simple pale blue dress with a fawn jacket, her raven hair tied back neatly. Hosha thought her skin was a shade darker than the last time he'd seen her. But then Trelawa, Anshun's capital, was in the tropics. She actually gave him a smile as he said hello. "Good to see you again," he said. "And you, Hosha. Sorry I left you carrying the ball on this one." "That's okay," he lied. "But I appreciate the way you carried on, and for calling me today. That's very professional." He gestured her toward the entrance to the garage. "You might yet regret coming. A lot of senior city police officers are on their way." "That I'm used to. You know, right now I'd actually welcome some of the old problems again. Tough case." "You wouldn't think so by the number of arrests we've made." She shrugged. "But yes, my opponent is an elusive man." "Holmes and Moriarty, yes?" "Hosha, I had no idea you read the classics." "It was some time ago, but I used to really enjoy that kind of thing." "Holmes never knew how easy he had it," she said as they reached the bottom of the ramp. "So what have you got for me?" Two white forensics department vans were parked at the far end of the garage. Various sensor patches the size of paving slabs had been stuck to the floor around the walls, and thick cables snaked around everywhere, winding back to the open access panel on both vans. Several general-purpose bots were moving the sensors around, clustering them in one corner while three forensics officers supervised. "We found them first thing this morning," Hosha said as they climbed into the back of the squad leader's van. The inside was cramped, a narrow corridor between two equipment benches, the air hot from all the humming electrical circuits. He was more than familiar with all the units. The additional forensics teams Mayo had promised from the Serious Crime Directorate had never materialized. In view of what amounted to her withdrawal from the case, Hosha's commander had reluctantly agreed to allocate him two of the city's forensics squads. Hosha himself had undergone the appropriate skill memory implementation so he could operate the equipment and interpret the results, helping his pitifully small team throughout all the dreary months that had followed. They had worked through the list of sites where construction work had been going on 40 years ago, a laborious and terribly tedious task. Sick days and short hours among the team members had been on a steady upward curve from the first week onward. There had been times, especially in the last few weeks, when only the GP bots had turned up at the start of the day's shift. Hosha had been receiving an increasing amount of pressure from both the team and his commander to wrap things up, but he'd kept doggedly to the list, examining the sites one after the other while soothing and cajoling the team, and pleading for just a little more time from the police department. Reflective deep scanning had revealed a great many interesting things buried beneath the city, but no bodies, until this morning. Paula peered closely at the small high-res holographic portal with its 3D grid of gentle pink luminescence. Right at the center were swirls of darker red, like knots in wood. "Even allowing for decomposition, you can see the shapes quite clearly," Hosha said, his finger tracing around denser swirls. "This is a head here, look, and these are arms and legs. Both bodies are inside some kind of box-shaped container. There's a distinct air cavity around each of them."
"I'll take your word for it. This looks like a Rorschach test to me."
Hosha avoided a smile. "One is slightly smaller than the other, which corresponds to a male-female pairing. But that's the end of the good news. They're deep, 10 meters down below this level. The developer didn't cut corners when this condo was built, unfortunately,
All the foundations correspond to City Hall regulations. Thank you, Hosha. We don't know it's them yet. We'll get a slightly better resolution when the sensors have been realigned, but that's not going to give us a positive ID. Only DNA will do that.
It's them. You know it is.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a bitch to get them out. We'll have to excavate all the way around. Probably need force fields to reinforce the foundation when we chop the block out. The residents will need to be moved out while we do that. Then we'll need to break the concrete up very carefully.
Don't worry. The Directorate has experienced extraction teams. I'll have them here before lunch.
You said that about the forensics teams. She shifted around in the cramped space and gave him an unnerving look of appraisal.
I know. And I apologize again.
I've never quite let anybody down like that before.
It won't happen again.
Hosha knew he was blushing. Her apology was like some intimate confession. He tapped a knuckle on the portal to distract her. Are you sure this will get a conviction? I'll bet you a whole Earth dollar their memory cell inserts have been destroyed. There'll be no memory of the killer we can ever access.
Trust me, Hosha. We can nail him now.
All I need is a judge to issue a warrant.
It was a hell of a row that broke out in the living room, loud enough for Morton to hear it from his bedroom, which made him stop what he was doing, which pissed him off no end. His e-butler told him who was invading his penthouse, so he was tying the belt on his dressing gown as he strode out.
Chief Inspector Mayo was arguing with his human butler, while Detective Hosha Finn interjected with angry threats. It was a credit to the butler's training and character that he didn't appear in any way flustered by the unwelcome guests and their authority. His loyalty lay solely with his employer. Nothing was going to shift that.
"Let's all take a breath and calm down," Morton said.
He combed his wild hair with his hand, trying to slick it back down.
"What seems to be the problem here,
Chief Investigator?"
"No problem." She held out a small memory crystal disc. "I have a warrant for your arrest."
"On what charge?"
"Two counts of body kill and deliberate memory erasure."
Morton couldn't quite hang on to his peaceable demeanor with that allegation fired at him.
"You've gotta be fucking joking!"
"No, sir, I am not joking," Paula said. "As a registered Commonwealth citizen, you are hereby advised not to speak further in connection with the offense you have just been charged with, until you are in consultation with your legal representative. Now, please get dressed, sir. You will be taken to the police precinct station for further questioning."
"This is bullshit!"
Morton stood his ground, folding his arms across his chest. Even though he knew, he asked, "Whose murder?"
"Tara Jennifer Shahif, your wife at the time, and Wyobi Kotal."
"Shit, I fucking told you they'd been bumped off!"
"You certainly did. Thank you for that, sir. Now please get dressed. If you don't, we will take you as you are."
A naked Melanie rushed into the lounge. She threw her arms around Morton.
"What's happening, Morty? What are they saying?"
"Nothing. It's a police fuck-up, that's all."
He almost shook her off, then thought better of it and returned her embrace.
"Everything is fine."
From inside the circle of his arms, she glared at the two officers. Hosha Finn was not looking at the naked teenager. Then he had to not look at the second girl who came to stand in the bedroom doorway, pulling on a white lace robe. Her long, elegant face wore a bemused expression as she took in the tableau, as if she was accessing some low-budget soap on the cybersphere.
"What is happening out here?"
she drawled in a husky voice. One hand patted languidly at her expensively styled hair.
"Is this part of your kink, Morty?
To be hauled off to a secret police dungeon where they manacle you to the wall?"
"No," Morton and Paula Mayo said in unison.
"Oh,"
she sounded disappointed.
"Morty never killed anyone," Melanie asserted.
She tossed her head, daring them to say different. Paula gave her a cool glance.
"You weren't even alive when he did this. Take my advice. Don't cause a scene.
Morton?"
"It's all right."
Morton gave the clinging girl a tender squeeze.
My e-butler has already informed the legal department. I'll be home for dinner tonight. We'll be suing for wrongful arrest before the fish course arrives.
Melanie pushed her face up toward his, entreating.
Don't go with them, please, Morty. Don't.
This is not a multiple-choice situation, Paula told her.
I'll get dressed, Morton said.
He swung around and walked back toward the bedroom.
It's a shame, he said to Paula. You and I could have been quite something together.
Paula looked from Melanie to the haughty girl in the lace robe, then to Morton.
I can't think what.
The daily storm that raced in from the Grand Triad had now passed, leaving the wide valley fresh and gleaming. There were few trees here on the northwestern edge of the Desault Mountains. The valley was mainly grassland, with boggy meadows along the bottom where the fast river flowed out to the north. Sunlight grew steadily warmer as the last twisting clouds hurried away toward the great Irrel steppes, and the ground steamed quietly. As soon as the rain stopped, Casimir stepped outside. The McFoster village on the western slopes was where he had spent his earliest childhood, a huddle of stone houses with living grass roofs that provided watertight shelter during the rains. They all had broad open windows so the air could circulate. Not that many daylight hours were spent indoors in such a warm climate. It was a farming village, one of the many sheltered refuges where clan children could grow up untroubled by the Institute and the Starflyer. Cattle grazed easily on the floor of the valley, and a few Charlemagnes were trained by fighters no longer able to answer the Guardian's call to arms. Scott and Harvey joined him as he walked out toward the memorial garden. More villagers joined in until there were over 30 marching silently along the little worn path. It ended at a dark wooden gate set in a dry stone wall that was overrun by colorful climbing nasturtiums. The wall circled a graveyard that followed the pattern adopted by most small human settlements across the Commonwealth. Saplings that had been planted around the perimeter were now large enough to offer some shade. Gravestones were carved on chunks of local rock. In the middle was an eight-sided memorial made of stone. The base plinth measured 3 meters across, holding a 2-meter sphere of red marble polished to a gleam. Names had been etched into the lower half, forming neat lines that covered nearly a third of the surface. Everyone gathered around and bowed their heads.
We have come today to celebrate the life of Bruce McFoster, Harvey said in a loud, clear voice. Although he has left our clan, he will not be forgotten by us and those who fight with us. When the time comes for this planet's revenge upon its violator, he will hear the song of joy that all peoples will sing, for it will be so loud as to rock the dreaming heavens themselves.
Harvey placed a small engraver tool against the marble at the end of an unfinished line of names. The little unit buzzed as its tiny blades began cutting the programmed pattern. Fine gray dust started to trickle down.
I remember your laughter, Bruce, Harvey said.
Casimir stepped forward.
I remember your friendship, Bruce. You are my brother and always will be.
It was difficult to get the words out as his voice cracked. Tears were leaking down his cheeks.
I remember your stubbornness, Bruce, Scott rasped. Keep it with you always, lad.
A woman stepped forward. Casimir didn't hear what she said. The infant boy that Samantha was cradling began to wail loudly, as if he understood what was happening, that he would never see or know his father. The tributes lasted for some time. Eventually, the last McFosters had their say, and the infant found the comfort of his mother's breast. The buzz of the engraver fell silent. Casimir stared brokenly at the new name on the marble, then hung his head, unable to bear the sight any longer. People drifted away, leaving him and Samantha alone.
Thank you, Kaz, she said quietly. Sometimes I think you and I are the only people who really cared about him.
Everybody cared, he said automatically. Samantha was a few years older than he was, which had always made him kind of awkward around her. Now with Bruce gone and the baby born, he was even more uncertain. She smiled, though it was clearly an effort. The infant was only 3 weeks old, and she looked very tired.
You're so sweet. Everybody knew him, especially my sisters in all the clans.
There's a difference. But at least he made his mark on this world, I think. Casimir put his arm around her shoulders and they walked out of the memorial garden together. Have you decided on his name yet?
Not Bruce.
That would be too much. I've chosen Lennox. That was Bruce's grandfather. And I have an uncle called that as well.
Lennox.
That's good. I expect that'll be shortened to Len.
Yes.
She stroked the infant's head. Lennox had lulled back into sleep again.
You should find someone, Kaz.
Huh? Someone for yourself. It's not right for anyone to be so alone. I'm fine, thanks. I get plenty of offers, don't worry. It was the kind of thing he used to say to Bruce. His mind went back to Andrea McNoack and his broken promise to Bruce. He never did try to bed her after that terrible raid. In fact, he'd never bothered with any girl since then. As always, he had the memory of Justine to comfort him through the long hours of every sleepless night. Scott and Harvey were waiting on the path, along with another man Casimir didn't know. Harvey beckoned.
I'll see you before you go, won't I? Samantha asked.
Of course you will.
I want...
If you need anything, help with the baby or something, please tell me.
You're not obligated, you know.
I want to see him, Samantha. I would have wanted that even if Bruce were still alive.
All right, then.
She stood on her toes and gave him a light kiss.
Thank you again, Kaz.
You'll make a wonderful uncle. He watched her walk off back to the village, a whole range of emotions messing his head around.
Nice girl,
Harvey said. I remember training her for a while.
Yeah,
Casimir said.
This is Stig McSobel,
Scott rasped in his damaged voice. Casimir shook hands with the stranger, surprised by how strong the grip was. He could look the man level in the eye, so he was no taller, but his shoulders were wide enough to stretch the fabric of his simple lace-up shirt. The McSobel was in his early 30s, with skin lighter than Casimir's, and a broad face that regarded the world with considerable amusement.
I've heard a lot about you, Kaz,
Stig said. You've earned quite a reputation for yourself on your last few raids. Casimir gave Scott and Harvey a sharp glance. Is this another lecture?
About recklessness and personal vengeance?
Harvey asked. Why should it be? Did you not pay attention last time? Casimir started to push past. Stig put out a hand to stop him. Again, the man's strength was very evident.
If you can keep that temper of yours under control, I can use you, Stig said. Harvey here says you can.
The ceremony should have been cathartic, and now you'll start to accept his death.
Is that right?
I saw Bruce's death. I watched him die, and I could do nothing.
I know what that's like.
We all do.
There's nothing unique about you and your grief, Casimir. You're a McFoster, a fighter. One day you'll die, and some other friend will watch it. Do you want their life to be blighted by that? We all have a right to live our lives as well, you know. There is more to us than the struggle against the Starflyer. This village shows that. Bruce's baby should show you more than anything.
But what the fuck else can I do? Casimir shouted. He was close to tears again, which would be an awful thing in front of the men he respected most.
I can fight, yes. And that's how I help bring about this better time we're all promised. If anger makes me fight harder, then good. Bruce would appreciate that.
Scott laid a hand on Casimir's arm.
Just listen to what Stig has to say, lad. Where's the harm in that, eh? We came to you with this because we're worried about you. We don't want to stop you fighting, but the way you are right now, you're going to get yourself killed on one of these raids, and for no good reason. This way you can still carry on the fight without deliberately putting yourself in so much danger. Now how about you just stay quiet for a minute while Stig says his piece, huh?
Casimir gave a rough shrug, knowing he was being a hothead idiot, not knowing how to stop.
Sure. Sorry. It's just...
He waved at the memorial garden.
Today. You know.
I do, Stig said. If you felt nothing for him, you would not be a true clansman. You would be nothing better than a Starflyer slave.
I respect what you're going through.
What did you want? You know the human starship has flown,
A herd, yeah.
Bradley Johansson believes its launch is the start of the Starflyer's endgame. It will bring ruin to the human commonwealth.
How?
Casimir asked. He never had quite understood how the human starship could be involved in their fight against the Starflyer. It was just an exploratory flight. The barrier around the Dyson Star was put up to contain a great evil. Johansson is worried that the humans will let it out. Some of the crew will be the Starflyer's slaves.
What kind of evil?
We don't know. But if the Commonwealth has to fight a war, it will be badly weakened, economically and socially. Such an action would leave humanity vulnerable to the Starflyer, as it gnaws at us from within.
But you said the starship has left. We can't stop it now.
No. But, Casimir, if the Starflyer is preparing to crush us, the time for the planet's revenge will soon be here, possibly within a few years. That means the Starflyer will return to far away, and we must be ready.
I know that.
Good. Now this is where I can use you. There are a number of items which must be brought to far away, so that the planet may have its revenge. Unfortunately, our supporters out there in the Commonwealth are being hunted down by the authorities that the Starflyer has corrupted. That means we have to set up alternative routes for the items we need. I've travelled around the Commonwealth. I know how it works. Now I have to get back and help our allies. But I'm going to take a small team of dedicated guardians with me to help achieve our final goal. I'd like you to be one of them.
Me?
Casimir asked in shock. Just the notion of leaving far away was awesome, let alone travelling around the planets whose names were closer to fable than fact. And she was out there.
Why me?
I don't know anything about the Commonwealth. You can learn, easily enough. Harvey says you are quick, which is good. Life there is very different, at least superficially. You must learn how to blend in easily. And you're young. Physically, you can still adapt. You'll have to train hard to build your muscles up to a point where your body can cope with standard gravity. There are drugs which can help, of course, and cellular reprofiling. But those techniques can't do it all. You'll need to commit yourself fully.
I can do that, he said without even thinking.
Was that a yes?
Yeah.
You will also have to obey orders. My orders. I cannot have you running around loose out there. This is the one operation that cannot be compromised, not ever. It is what the Guardians are, why we exist.
I understand that. I won't let you down.
I'm sure you won't, Kaz. But it will be Johansson who makes the final decision. Casimir gave Scott and Harvey a confused glance.
What decision?
If you can help bring back what we need, Harvey said. The physical training is only half of your preparation. You really are going to have to learn how to behave like a Commonwealth citizen. I promised Stig you could do that. Please don't make me a liar.
Never, but...
Johansson will decide.
Yes, Stig said.
You'll meet him before we begin the operation. Casimir could barely believe what he was hearing. As far as he was concerned, Bradley Johansson was some remote icon that everyone quoted and deferred to. A historical giant. He wasn't someone you got to meet in the flesh.
Fine,
Casimir said faintly.
Where is he?
At the moment. I don't know. But we'll meet him on Earth. While she was being built, the second chance was the Unisphere's primary news story. Details of her design, stories about her construction, spun briefings on the politics behind the decision to build her, gossip on who would be picked for her crew, it all pumped up the ratings for any news media show. Then came the Alamo Avengers attack, and modest interest became outright fascination. It culminated with over 17 billion people accessing her departure for Dyson Alpha in real time. After that, as she traversed hyperspace for month after month, there was a distinct feeling of anticlimax and even a little frustration. Commonwealth citizens simply weren't used to anything that important being offline. Worse, it would be a year until they did hear what happened. Until then, everybody would just have to fall back on the old familiars of TSI soaps and dramas, squabbling politicians, badly behaved celebrities, and the Commonwealth Cup now moving into the quarterfinals. The news of Morton's arrest was released,
along with the names of the arresting officers, and every train to Oaktier was suddenly full of reporters hungry for more information. The case was a studio editor's dream, a Paula Mayo investigation of an ice murder, a wealthy suspect with big political and business connections, a strong hint of financial scandal. And sex. What had once been idle Oaktier gossip about Morton seducing the beautiful young Melanie and ruining her chances on the national diving team was pushed high up the coverage agenda, featuring heavily on every report and info profile. His earlier conquests were soon tracked down and coaxed into telling their stories for respectable sums of money. Bribes were offered to Dark Lake City forensics officers to reveal exclusive insights into the evidence that the prosecution would present, which led to 5 subsequent contempt of court proceedings. Tara Jennifer Shahif and Wyobi Kotal were forced to apply for non-harassment court injunctions against the swarms of reporters laying siege to their homes. After a month's build-up, expectations were running high. On the first morning of the trial, Dark Lake Superior Courthouse had to be cordoned off from the frenzy of media and public interest. Street barriers pushed the expectant crowd back half a city block. A long convoy of police cars and patrol bots escorted the prisoner van around to the secure reception area at the rear of the courthouse, its movements followed by cameras on 12 helicopters. They never got a glimpse of Morton. The van vanished into a locked garage bay. The trial venue was Court One, which the judicial authorities had hurriedly spent a large amount of their annual maintenance budget on sprucing up. With Oaktier about to spend at least a week in the focus of the entire Commonwealth, impressions were suddenly paramount. The rich golden Brentwood panelling around the dock and judge's bench was buffed. Both of the lawyers' long, heavy tables were resurfaced and waxed. The walls and ceiling were repainted, with the big justice symbol taken out for cleaning. Every poly photo strip shone down brightly. The sound system was checked and balanced correctly. The revamp worked. When the 50 selected pool reporters were finally allowed in on the first morning, they all remarked to their audiences how solemn and dignified the chamber was. The kind of place you could put your trust in, knowing that here justice was both fair and thorough. Presentation was also foremost in the defense strategy. The first time Morton was seen since his arrest was when he walked into the packed courtroom, dressed in a deep purple designer suit, his thick hair perfectly styled, and looking very confidential, most mystified as to why he was here. It was not the image of a guilty man awaiting the inevitable verdict that Paula Mayo always got when she prosecuted. As he reached the dock, he bowed politely to the curving panel of silver one-way glass that shielded the jury and protected their identities. Just before he sat down, he glanced around the packed public gallery, found who he was looking for, and smiled warmly. Every reporter swiveled around, retinal inserts focusing on Melanie, who was perched elegantly in the front row, wearing a stylish navy blue jacket and plain white blouse. Dressed so, she managed to project herself as both the epitome of bewildered innocence and tremendously sexy. Just an ordinary girl next door standing by her man in the face of a terrible injustice. Then Paula Mayo walked in, wearing a smart gray business suit and black leather shoes. Formidably cool, she exuded her own special brand of confidence. In the studios of 100 news shows, they once again ran the clip of an impassive 16-year-old Paula at her parents' hugely emotional trial. As it showed across the Commonwealth, she sat down between the city's chief attorney, Ivor Chessel, and Hosha Finn, whose best suit appeared ancient and derelict amid the high-fashion statements that the principals were wearing. Judge Carmichael made his entrance, and everybody stood. Morton flashed a reassuring grin up to Melanie, captured by 50 professional pairs of inserts. Once the charges had been read out, the defense lawyer, Howard Maddock, immediately applied for a dismissal, citing contamination of evidence by the media. Ivor Chessel attested that the evidence itself was still sound and irrefutable, and only a small part of the prosecution case. Judge Carmichael rejected the appeal, and with the posturing over, the trial began in earnest. Prosecution laid the case out simply. Morton was a man driven by his raging manic thirst for money and power. His marriage to Tara Jennifer Shahif was a simple and ruthless first step to achieving that goal. Her family money was used to fund Aquastate, giving that small company the financial muscle to go after and win large building development contracts. Aquastate under Morton's fiery management grew successfully until it was ready to go public. The share flotation was all part of his original grand scheme. It made him rich and gave him the leverage he needed to gain a seat on Gansu's board. After that, his rise was unstoppable. But his plan had faced ruin as his then-wife, Tara Jennifer Shahif, grew bored with their marriage. If she filed a divorce, Aquastate would either be wound up or sold off, and the proceeds split between them. Morton would still be rich, a lot richer than he was at the start of the marriage, but it wasn't enough for his purpose. It was still too early for the flotation to take place. Aquastate wasn't quite big enough to attract investors. That required another 2 or 3 years of uninterrupted growth. "So you killed her," Ivor Chessel said, standing in front of the dock. "You removed the one obstacle left to flotation, your own wife. And with her out of the way, supposedly living on Tampico, you were free to build up Aquastate to the level you required." Morton gave Howard Maddock a helpless look, unable to believe anyone could make such an absurd accusation. The defense lawyer, a dignified man who kept his appearance firmly middle-aged, with the first frost of silver in his hair, shook his head sadly at such blatant theatrics by the prosecution. The first prosecution witness was the city's head of forensics, Sharon Hofbrand. She confirmed that the bodies dug out of the 40-year-old condo's foundations were indeed Tara Jennifer Shahif and Wyobi Kotal. They had both been shot at close range by a very high-powered nerve jam weapon, and their memory cell inserts had been erased, probably by an EM pulse. The exact time was slightly difficult to pin down after so long, but she could narrow it down to a 3-day period in the middle of the week when Morton was away at the conference in Talensee. Chessel then asked if they'd found any foreign DNA traces on either of the bodies. "No," Hofbrand said. "Kotal was fully clothed. There were the normal particles and dirt you'd expect from moving through the city, but no extraneous DNA. Shahif was naked, but we found traces of soap and perfume chemicals on her skin, indicating she had been in the bath." "Can you tell if she was shot in the bath?" Chessel asked.
"Not after so much time has elapsed, no."
"But she was in the bath at least prior to the slaying?"
"Yes."
"So she was at home then?"
"That's likely, yes."
"Thank you." Ivor Chessel turned to the judge. "No more questions, Your Honor."
Howard Maddock smiled as he got to his feet.
"Home or a hotel? Can you really tell the difference?"
"No, it could have been either.
Or a friend's house. Or a public washroom.
Somewhere with a bath is as specific as I can get. Was it on Oak Tier? There's no way of knowing."
"I see. Thank you."
Prosecution called Tara Jennifer Shahif. She took the stand wearing a lavender suit with wide white trimming and a too short skirt. Her hair and too lavish makeup emphasized how nervous she looked.
"Do you recall having any enemies 40 years ago?" Ivor Chessel asked.
"No, I didn't lead that kind of life. I still don't."
"So you certainly weren't aware of anyone wanting to kill you?"
"No."
"Do you have any memory or knowledge of visiting the planet Tampico?"
"No, I'd never heard of it until I was relifed."
"What about Brower Associates?"
"The lawyers? No. I heard about them at the same time I did Tampico, when the insurance investigators looked into my disappearance."
Tara's eyes watched Howard Maddock as he walked over to her. She hadn't yet managed to glance in Morton's direction.
"The prosecution is relying very heavily on the assumption that you were about to divorce my client," he said. "Were you?"
"I don't think so. There was no definite plan that I remember. We would have parted eventually. The marriage was moving closer to its sell-by date."
"Is that why you were having an affair?"
"One of the reasons, yes. Life was sweet. YOB made it sweeter."
"Life was sweet," Maddock repeated thoughtfully.
"I see.
Do you still see Morton?"
"Sometimes, yes. I don't avoid him."
She gave a brittle laugh.
So you're good friends, then?
As best as you can be with an ex. He was supportive when I was relifed. It's quite a shock waking up to find that's happened to you. The therapists say some people take another lifetime to get over it.
So it would be fair to say there is no ill will between you and Morton, Maddock asked.
No, that is, I had no reason to suspect any until this blew up.
If you had gone and done what the prosecution claimed, and filed for divorce that very week you were killed, would you have insisted that Aquastate be wound down or split in half, as your marital agreement stated?
Objection, Ivor Chessel said. That requires speculation.
Hardly, Your Honor, Maddock said smoothly. I'm asking the prosecution witness what she would actually have done under very specific circumstances. While the entire prosecution case rests upon what might have happened if she did as they believe. Which of us is speculating?
I happen to agree with you in this instance, the judge said. How the witness believes she would have reacted is not speculation. Please answer the question.
I'm not sure, Tara stammered. Money wasn't too big an issue for me. I still had access to family funds. I suppose I would have allowed Aquastate to continue. Morton would probably have made a good case for getting it ready for flotation.
So you were never angry with him?
No. All marriages end. Everybody knows that. That's why we have contracts at the beginning.
Howard Maddock was very careful not to smile at the prosecution team as he sat down. The second day began with Hosha Finn taking the stand. He was still in his one best suit with his hair slicked back into the silver clasp he always used. While Paula had chosen a black jacket and light tweed skirt, still every inch the unflappable professional, Morton had gone for expensively casual, with an open-necked white shirt under a gold embossed waistcoat. His lawyer was wearing the same suit as the previous day, careful to project style without ostentation. Looking down on them and smiling encouragement when required, Melanie had selected a pale gray dress, cut tight enough to qualify as an overskin.
Detective Finn, Ivor Chessel began, is there any evidence Tara Jennifer Shahif or Y.O.B. Kotal ever went to Tampico?
The tickets were bought and the law firm hired, but there is no evidence either of them were ever there. We performed an extensive search. There was simply no data or physical trace of them ever being on that planet. We believe the whole Tampico scenario is an alibi for the killer.
An alibi?
If Morton killed his wife to guarantee the flotation of Aquastate, he couldn't afford to have anybody asking questions about where she was. As far as everyone else was concerned, she had run off with her lover to set up house on a new world. The legal firm of Brower Associates was hired to carry on the fiction by acting on her behalf. There was a lot more. Methods used during the search. Verification of police records. Results into inquiries conducted into Y.O.B. Kotal's life to see if he had enemies prepared to kill. The official accounts for Aquastate, all of them designed to show how the inquiry had carefully narrowed down options until it could be nobody else but Morton. It wasn't until the afternoon that defense began its questions. Howard Maddock got Hosha to tell the court how the original investigation of Kotal's relife was winding down when Morton intervened to get the case assigned a higher priority.
Very curious thing for him to do, if he is the killer, isn't it? Maddock asked.
He wouldn't know he murdered Shahif and Kotal, Hosha said. The first thing he would do is have the memory erased.
You know that, do you?
We examined his secure memory store. There is no memory of the event.
Was there a full memory of the week-long convention he was attending at the time of this terrible crime?
Essentially, yes. However, he could have returned to Dark Lake City during what was logged in the secure store as a sleep period.
You examined my client's secure memory store. Is there any memory of him ever having been to Tampico?
No.
But if he killed...
Just answer the question you were asked, please, Detective. You have no evidence my client set up this alibi.
Would I be right in saying that the person or persons who did actually kill Tara Shahif would have needed this alibi to deflect any police or private inquiry about her whereabouts?
Yes.
In the course of your investigation,
Did you find anyone else with a motive to kill these two unfortunate people?
No. There was nothing. No other reason except Morton's.
What about Tara and Wyobi unexpectedly walking in on some deeply illegal criminal gang activity?
Was that considered?
Yes. We examined it as a possibility. There was no evidence to support the idea.
Well, there wouldn't be, would there? If the gang who killed them were smart enough to deliver an alibi that stood for 40 years, they're hardly going to leave evidence lying around. Their only piece of bad luck was my client spotting the real-life connection, and asking questions in high places, doing his duty, being a good citizen. And this is his reward.
While all we have here in court is your theory mangled to fit the facts, a notion which is based solely on your assumption that my client is a cold, ruthless man. Am I right in that?
Yes, that's what the facts support.
But they don't, Detective. That's not evidence.
That's your theory.
It is not evidence. Not some blood-stained blunt instrument in a plastic bag which you can hold up here in court and point to.
It is the most tenuous, circumstantial theory. So I ask you again, is there any evidence, physical or digital, that definitely rules out Wyobi Kotal and Tara Jennifer Shahif walking in on a criminal activity and being killed to shut them up? And incidentally, why their memory cell inserts were erased?
Osha stared ahead for a long moment, then cleared his throat.
No, there is no physical or digital evidence which rules that out, he said in a monotone.
As the court recessed for the day, the talking heads in media studios across the Commonwealth were nearly unanimous that Howard Maddock had done a good demolition job on Osha Finn. A great deal of the prosecution case was subjecture. It could be enough for a good defense lawyer to swing the jury in his favor. Public sympathy was definitely moving toward Morton, according to the constant interactive polls monitoring opinion on the case. It acted like a feedback loop, giving even more people the impression he was going to get off, which implied an even bigger revelation was waiting to be accessed. Paula Mayo was actually going to lose a case. After such momentous events, Day 3 brought an unsurprising increase in the Unisphere audience. Close to 3 billion people were online and waiting to see what would happen. They watched as Melanie arrived early and took her usual seat. This morning she was wearing a long coat of some shiny ice blue fabric with matching trousers. The vest underneath was a translucent mesh, though the coat's lapels remained very close together, hinting at, rather than revealing, any flesh. With her hair given a sophisticated wave and combed back neatly, she was radiating raw sex appeal. After yesterday's roasting, Osha Finn was wearing a lighter suit, for once allowing his oiled hair to fall loose over his shoulders. Next to him, Paula was in a somber dark green suit, her hair scraped back severely. When the court officer brought Morton in, he'd put on a navy blue suit appropriate for any boardroom meeting, emphasizing his authority and integrity. His face was sober and intent, betraying no hint of contentment at what had happened yesterday. He was restrained as he shook hands with Howard Maddock. Then they both stood as Judge Carmichael entered. With the prosecution case over, defense called its first witness, Morton himself. Howard Maddock faced the shielded jury as he asked his opening question. For the record, do you believe yourself capable of committing such a dreadful act as this murder undoubtedly is?
I do not believe I could kill in cold blood, and I did not kill my wife and her lover.
Thank you. Maddock went through a long series of questions designed to show his client in the best possible light to the jury. How Morton was ambitious, but not so ruthless as to use murder to his corporate advantage. How he had shown sympathy and support for his ex-wife after her re-life procedure. How he would have risen to the top, no matter what trivial little financial problems beset him 40 years ago. The prosecution has made much of how cold and ruthless you are, Maddock finished. Are you a cold man? Morton looked up to the public gallery where Melanie was sitting, gazing down with a soft, devoted smile on her beautiful young face.
You'd have to ask those who know me properly, but I don't think so.
Howard Maddock bowed slightly to the judge and sat down. Your witness, Judge Carmichael told the prosecution table.
Everyone in the courtroom fell silent as Paula Mayo slowly stood up. Then a round of excited whispering broke out as she bowed to the judge and walked over to the witness stand. If she was having to take charge herself, the prosecution must be desperate. "Murder ain't what it used to be," she said to Morton in a pleasant, conversational tone. "It's no longer death. Not final. Today it's body loss, memory erasure, lots of euphemisms that describe what is essentially a discontinuity in consciousness. Your body can be killed, but the clinics on every Commonwealth planet can bring you back to life with a simple cloning procedure. There's a blank decade or two, but eventually you're walking around again as if nothing ever happened. It's a wonderful psychological crutch to have. A lot of psychiatrists argue that it helps make our society a lot more stable and calm than before. They bandy the word mature around quite a lot. So you see, murdering somebody is nothing like as serious as it used to be. All you're actually doing is removing them from the universe for a few years. You're not really killing them, especially when you know their insurance will cover a relife procedure. It would probably be an acceptable risk to remove someone who was going to ruin your plans. No, Morton said, it is completely unacceptable. It is not a done thing, something that can be performed for convenience. Murder is barbarism. I wouldn't do it. Not now, not 40 years ago. But we are agreed that your wife and Wyobi Kotal were murdered. Of course. He frowned, puzzled by the question. I told you. Remember? No. You originally said you were suspicious about her disappearance, especially when it coincided with that of her lover. Feelings of unease aren't entirely memory-based. They can't be erased by legal or black market editing. They are derived from the subconscious. You knew something was wrong about their disappearance. Morton sat back and gave her a suspicious stare. The Tampico alibi was a good one, wasn't it? Paula said. Yes. Yes. Assuming you no longer had the memory of murdering her, neither you nor her other friends ever questioned the story that she'd left you to go there. I didn't kill her. But you're right, it was a watertight cover-up. I had no reason to question her disappearance, especially after Brower Associates contacted me and said they were acting as intermediaries. Let's examine this again. You came back from your conference in Talency and found your apartment had been stripped of all your wife's things, her clothes and possessions, and there was a message telling you she had left for good. That's right. And that was enough to convince you at the time that there was nothing unusual about her leaving. It was unusual and unexpected and quite shocking, but it didn't make me suspicious. So you knew of her affairs? Yes. There had been several by then. Our marriage allowed for them. I had a couple myself. I'm only human, not some cold machine. Did you argue the terms of the divorce? No. They were all set out in the marriage contract. I knew what I was getting into. What about the items removed from your apartment? Did you ask for any of them to be returned? No. Why not? Morton gave Maddock a quick glance. Tara only took her own stuff. You knew what was hers, did you? Sure. Did anybody else? This time the glance Morton shot at his lawyer was a puzzled one. Excuse me? I read the transcripts of all your calls and messages to Brower Associates, Paula said. There was never any dispute over what was removed. So tell me this. In a home where two people have lived together for 12 years, where only those two people could possibly know whose item was whose, how is it that the killer removed only her property? Morton's expression turned to one of stricken incomprehension. He opened his mouth as if to speak, but no words came out. No criminal gang would ever know what to take to set up the alibi, Paula said. It would take someone intimate with the house and its contents. There were only two of you with the exact knowledge. One of them is your ex-wife, and we know she didn't do it. Morton slowly lowered his head into his hands, covering his grief and confusion. Oh, holy shit, he moaned. I didn't.
Did I?
Yes. Paula regarded him with the kind of sympathy normally extended to the bereaved. You did.
The jury took 3 hours to deliberate their verdict. Comment on the Unisphere was that they took so long in order to enjoy a decent lunch at the taxpayers' expense. When they filed back into the courtroom and delivered their verdict, nobody was surprised that it was unanimous. The electronically disguised voice from behind the curving silver glass announced, "Guilty." The outbreak of chatter was swiftly silenced by the judge, who then told Morton to stand. There were, the judge said, very firm guidelines laid down for such appalling crimes. The minimum was usually twice the period of life loss.
Given that you committed this crime purely for your own advancement, I have to agree with the prosecution's assessment that you are a cold, immoral individual who sees other people's lives as an inconvenience to your own ambition and has no qualm in eradicating such problems. Due to your evil, Tara Jennifer Shahif and Wyobi Kotal have suffered the loss of decades without a body. I therefore have no reluctance to imposing a punishment of 120 years of life suspension. Sentence to begin immediately. His gavel banged down loudly.
Tara Jennifer Shahif leaped to her feet and screeched, "You bastard!" at her ex.
On the other side of the public gallery, a hysterical Melanie screamed incoherently, struggling against the court officials holding her back from jumping the railings to be with her guilty lover. Some members of the public around her were cheering merrily at the commotion. Morton shook his head in bewilderment as he was led out of the dock, a study in tragicomic defeat. The reporters turned en masse to the prosecution table. Hosha Finn and Ivor Chessel were clearly delighted, smiling wildly as they shook hands. Paula Mayo seemed oblivious to the commotion all around her. She was picking up loose sheets of hard copy and slotting them neatly into her briefcase. The table cleared. She walked out of the courtroom without looking around.